Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to today's Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley program, brought to you from the Oshman Family JCC in Palo Alto. My name is Dan Weiss. It's my pleasure to introduce Professor Jeffrey Sachs, director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University and author of The Price of Civilization, Reawakening American Virtue and Prosperity. Professor Sachs is a leading expert in economic development, poverty alleviation, and environmental sustainability, and has worked as an advisor to governments and international organizations in Latin America, Eastern Europe, the former Soviet Union, Asia, and Africa. He is a special advisor to UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon and served 4 years as the director of the UN Millennium Project and special advisor to UN Secretary General Kofi Annan. Currently, Professor Sachs is the Quetelet Professor of Sustainable Development and Professor of Health Policy and Management at Columbia University and president and co-founder of Millennium Promise Alliance, a nonprofit organization tackling extreme global poverty. He received his PhD, MA, and BA from Harvard University, where he also spent 20 years as a professor and later director of the Center for International Development. Dr. Sachs was named twice by Time magazine as one of the 100 most influential leaders in the world, and in 2005 won the Sargent Shriver Award for Equal Justice. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Professor Jeffrey Sachs.
Good evening. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to try to use the mic here so that I can stand in front of you. I don't want to stand behind this box, but I would like to stand in front of you so that we can have a nice chat this evening. And let me thank you and people listening on the radio for the chance to have a discussion about the situation in the United States now, which I think all of us feel is not what we expect of this country. And I have written the book, The Price of Civilization, as my own attempt to try to unravel a pretty serious conundrum of how the United States, a country that we have long believed is able to take on great challenges and meet great global responsibilities as well as global competition, finds itself stuck economically, divided socially, and seemingly paralyzed politically. And I think that the opinion data reflect something quite serious in terms of the underlying mood in this country. The overwhelming majority of Americans feel that our country is on the wrong track right now. And perhaps most stunning of all, the distance between the public and Washington is greater than at any time in our modern history. The approval ratings for Congress, as I'm sure most of you have seen, have fallen below 10% approval in the most recent polls. That's just random error at the bottom. That is not any kind of decisive support for Congress, even among 10%, I fear. And one of the data points, as I was writing this book, that most shocked me and disturbed me is a finding in a number of surveys that Americans feel that Washington is itself a special interest group now, not our democracy, not really representative of the public. And that is not only a mood and a measure of our frustration with the state of the economy, but in very real ways, it's a reflection of a disconnection, I believe, between American values and American attitudes with respect to specific policies and what's coming out of the Washington political mill. Because often we hear the question raised, what's wrong with Americans? Why are they voting for this one or that one? Why are they supporting this policy or that policy? And I think the fairest thing to say about this is nothing's wrong with the majority of Americans, even the vast majority, in terms of attitudes. The real disconnection is between what Americans want and what our political process is producing. So this book, for me, was an unexpected book after working for more than a quarter century outside of the United States and working with dozens of countries on their economic challenges. I did not really expect that the U.S. Would fall into a trap like this. I did feel that during the quarter century in which I've been an economic advisor to governments in many parts of the world, that the U.S. was in some sense disappearing from the foreign radar screen. Other than our war zones, I find that I can now go months, even a year or two, without any real U.S. leadership on many of the most important and urgent problems in other places in the world. What we're seeing here is also very much true abroad, that U.S. Government leadership has basically diminished and almost disappeared. I was in 20 countries this summer, and I can't recall a single meeting of all of the international meetings that I attended where the U.S. played a leadership role, whether it was on issues of global energy or climate or the drought crisis in the Horn of Africa, or business in World Economic Forum meetings in Asia. And this was another motivation for me to try to understand what was happening back home. Of course, I live here and I work here and I teach here, but my focus has been abroad. I felt finally that one needed to use the same kinds of tools that one would apply to an economic crisis elsewhere to try to understand the U.S. situation. Now, I would also say that as I wrote this book, I felt very much that I was peeling an onion, where the problems on the surface really were symptoms. They were not the core of our challenges, but they were rather manifestations of deeper problems, and those manifestations that led us back in time to more original causes that needed to be sorted out. And many people feel that our current crisis is a crisis of financial markets after 2008, or perhaps is a reflection of the buildup of the subprime crisis that built up during the past decade. My argument in this book is that the American economic crisis, and I do believe it is a crisis, the crisis of the economy and of the politics and society, has causes and roots that go back several decades, and that even the financial bubble and its bursting in 2008 really is itself almost a symptom rather than a fundamental explanation of our current problems. That leads me also, when I come to the challenge of what to do, to take a view that is quite different from both political parties, and unfortunately quite different from President Obama, whom I supported and support as our president and expect to support next year politically. But I find that the policies that the White House has been pursuing since President Obama came to office are nothing more than short-term tactics in the face of very deep structural problems. And I find this a matter of great regret, because I can't imagine a situation more primed than in early 2009 for taking on some of the deeper challenges that our country phases. So let me quickly wind the story back to where I think it begins, explain how we got here, and then turn to some of the differences between what I feel is needed and the way that our politics is running. This has to be very abbreviated, but we'll sit down with Michael Moritz in a few minutes and have a question and answer session so that we can discuss these issues. So I'll do a very quick tour of the issues. I take the story back already to the mid-1970s, because this was a period when the U.S. first was buffeted by a number of shocks that we didn't understand very well and that were rather unprecedented. In the early 1970s, the U.S. dollar was thrown off of its perch at the center of the international monetary system. That happened in 1971. And then in 1973, there was the first oil price explosion that revolved around OPEC's new power and the inflationary era. But we first entered the period of high oil prices after decades of very, very low, indeed rock-bottom, energy prices. In 1973 and 74, food prices soared for the first time, and we got our first glimpse of what was to come later on. By the second half of the 1970s, the U.S. economy was starting to feel a kind of competition that it was absolutely not expecting, and that was first felt from Japan with the arrival of highly competitive automobiles and electronics and the glimmerings of other economies in Asia, of course, Hong Kong, Singapore, Taiwan, Korea, Asian manufacturing tigers starting to penetrate U.S. markets. And then the big one happened in 1978, but in a way that we didn't really know or recognize for a couple of decades afterwards. And that was China, the vast country of 1.3 billion people, opened up to world markets when Deng Xiaoping came to power. And China began a path of development that was modeled on Japan and Korea and the other countries in the neighborhood of becoming a major manufacturing export economy. Now, all of that period of the 1970s was a period of turmoil. Of course, in the political side, you had Watergate and Vietnam, and it shook the U.S., and it led to a pretty dramatic change of our politics. And we have to thank California for that to some extent, because out of this unhappiness emerged a couple of themes that really played a very important role in the United States since then. Of course, California pioneered in the tax revolt at the end of the 1970s and then handed us a president in the 1980 elections. And what I think was most decisive about Ronald Reagan's election was, in essence, not just the political powers that he brought into Washington leadership, but actually an idea that stuck. Because as everybody knows, when Reagan became president in January 1981, he made a statement which reflected a new way of governing and which took hold in a very deep way in American politics. And that was the statement that government is not the solution. Government is the problem. And if I have one recommendation, it is that somebody that believes that should not run for president because they are looking for the wrong job. And indeed, Reagan, I think, put this country on a path that turned out to be very, very damaging, and that is the legacy that we have till today. Government became demonized. Government was attributed to government was the source of these problems, whether it was the inflation or the shocks or the instability. Whereas, in fact, a quite different dynamic was taking hold, but one that we failed to diagnose. While Reagan said that the problem was government and the key was to get government off our backs, what actually was happening in the 1970s was the formation, the early formation, of a new global economy. So we were entering the era of a new and intense globalization that called upon the United States and every other country to do new things in order to hold together economically, in order to hold together socially, and in order to hold together politically. And if I could put it admittedly in a crude kind of way, when you make a wrong diagnosis and you treat a patient on that wrong diagnosis and you do it for 30 years, you end up in a calamitous mess, and that's the one that we're in today. By saying that government was the problem, by cutting top tax rates at exactly the moment when globalization was going to give the biggest push to new investment opportunities for those with the technology and the cash, but was also going to create tremendous difficulties and hardships for working class people who now were competing with Chinese and other workers halfway around the world, we set off on a process by which politics amplified these powerful undercurrents of the world economy. And the shocks from the world economy were powerful enough in creating difficulties for working class and poor people. But then came politics and gave to those who had even more, and to those who were suffering, began to strip away the basic social safety net. And the argument that I make in the book is that it's this dual feedback process of markets and politics feeding each other, leading to what has now become a society that was, back in 1970, the middle-class society of the world, increasingly being the divided society in the world. The society where there are some at the top doing extraordinarily well, those at the very top doing unimaginably well because the level of wealth that has been accumulated at the very top in America is absolutely mind-boggling, where a few hundred people have more than $1 trillion of net worth. But what's happened for the rest of society is that a large part of our country can't manage, can't find a foothold, and is falling through the bottom, falling out of the middle class, falling into chronic instability, falling into unemployment, into loose labor force attachment, and in the more extreme cases, into overt poverty. Now, the book is filled with data on all of these things, and I don't have time this evening, and perhaps it's a little hard to, in any event, go through the data carefully, let me show you a couple of things that I think are quite telling. And for people on the radio, I'll try to describe what it is that we're seeing. The graph on the left is a graph of the share of national income taken in the blue line by the top 1% of American households and the red line by the top 0.01%. That's the richest 12,000 households in America. We have 120 million households in total. And what you can see is a U-shape where there was a high share of income going to the very top early on, and then it rises sharply. Now let's look at the years. The peak of the share of high income in the early phase is 1929. Unfortunately, an infamous year in U.S. and world history. That's the year of the onset of the Great Depression. In 1929, we had huge inequality of income, and the top 1% was taking in about 25% of total income received by households. After the Great Depression, the New Deal, World War II, the GI Bill, the growth in the 1960s and 1970s, you see that the share at the top came down to about 9% of the total received by the top 1%. But then that curve starts to turn upward again. It starts around 1980. It is, in my view, the forces that Reagan brought in to this country and that presidents since then have persisted in following. And you see that that 9% collected at the top has grown again to around 23.5% as of 2008. In other words, we've had soaring inequality over a period of 30 years. Amazingly, the bottom 1% of, the top 0.01% shown in the bottom line, which took in about 5% of all household income, those 12,000 families, had more combined income than the poorest 24 million households in 2008. That's the staggering measure of our inequality. Now, the graph on the right is equally stunning. That's just the median earnings of a full-time male worker. And you see that it's been flat for almost 40 years. That peak of the median earnings of a full-time male worker occurred in 1973. Since then, there has been no increase in the average earnings of a male worker in this country. That's almost 40 years of stagnation. Of course, GNP has continued to grow, but all of that growth has been at the top of the income distribution, not in the middle, not at the median. And one more picture, and then I'll turn to the implications. Of course, unemployment soared. We know that. That's our number one challenge right now, that it's stuck at about 9% unemployment. But if you look at this picture, the unemployment rate is high for those with lower educational attainment. This is not surprising. Our society has divided according to educational attainment. If you don't have a high school diploma in this country, the unemployment rate is about 15%, but many, many more millions have just given up any hope of finding stable work. If you have a bachelor's degree or higher, the unemployment rate is still low at about 4% in the most recent data. What's amazing and perhaps not well appreciated is that even today, with all the efforts at achieving college education throughout the society, it's still the case that two-thirds of our kids don't make it through a four-year bachelor's degree. Only around one-third, maybe 35 to 40%, depending on the year, the cohort, the economy, make it through a four-year bachelor's degree. And the nature of the global economy today is such that the jobs for those without a high school, without a college degree are scarce. The earnings have been stagnant or falling. The stability of such jobs is very, very low. And this is the greatest divide in our society between the haves and the have-nots. You can think of our society as having three parts now. One is at the very top, the super rich who have, through many means, their stock options and Wall Street bonuses and good luck in globalization have been able to make a fortune. Then the college grads and above, in general, who have benefited from globalization. And then the rest of society, which is about 60%. Which has seen stagnation of earnings and many people falling to the bottom, living now in overt poverty or in chronic instability, especially if there's ill health and an inability physically to sustain work. And that, I believe, is the essence of our challenge, which is that for 30 years, we cut government. We cut the basis for an inclusive society. We failed to provide the means to ensure that all parts of society could see their children through to success. We put a lot of kids into the beginning of college only to see them drop out because they can't afford the tuitions. School loans are completely inadequate. They end up without the skills to be able to compete. We've lost millions and millions of jobs abroad. And while this was denied for a long time, I think the data are now quite overwhelming that a lot of our manufacturing sector disappeared under this pressure, because the only parts that have remained are those that are based on high education and high technology that can be done in the U.S. But the mainstream way to a middle-class life in this country was closed off for those that were typically and historically finishing with a high school degree. In other countries, the response to this was to help. It was to say, we have an inclusive society. In America, it was the opposite. It was to cut taxes on the rich. It was to cut social services. And it was to put our country on 30 years of demonization of government. And ladies and gentlemen, this was not really a partisan issue. Reagan started it, but it continued through the Clinton administration. What was called welfare reform was a pretty cruel set of policies, actually, to throw poor women out into the mercy of the market without help on childcare, without help on preschool, without programs of early childhood development. The Bush administration, my least favorite in modern American history, amplified all of this. I still am tackling with the difficult question of whether he was the worst president in all of history or whether he comes in number two behind James Buchanan. Maybe we can opine on that later. But unfortunately, President Obama came in with big hopes and a promise of change and wonderful speeches, but he never connected the speeches to the policies to the budget. For a long time, this weakness in the labor market was partially hidden by a housing bubble, and that gave jobs to construction workers. When that ended, even that refuge was lost. And so both manufacturing and construction were no place to create jobs, and we've sat with very high, chronically high unemployment, except if you're highly skilled and highly educated in this country. What President Obama should have done was to forge a many-year, I would say a 10-year program to bolster education, infrastructure investment, modernization, science and technology. What we got instead was stimulus. The idea of stimulus is a jolt to the economy to get it back on track. And that would make sense if the crisis were a short-term crisis. But if the crisis is structural, a two-year program isn't going to solve anything. And it is what President Obama ended up declaring plaintively. He said, you know, I basically, and I'm paraphrasing, he said, I learned that there were no shovel-ready projects. And we actually don't want to give our kids shovels, frankly speaking. We want to give our kids skills. We want to give our kids better employment. And that's not what has been done. Everybody wants gimmicks. The Republican Party just wants to continue to slash. It's the cruelest and most misguided thing I can imagine. I don't know what's in their heads, because 30 years of this is where we are today. They say that the public sector doesn't create jobs. The public sector, ladies and gentlemen, creates skills. It creates employable people. It creates education. It helps to create science on which our country was able to prosper. It creates the infrastructure on which we're able to be productive internationally. They don't understand that. So they're on one riff, cut taxes at the top, help the people who are already unbelievably rich to get richer. The level of greed, irresponsibility, and bad diagnosis is something, to my mind, that has almost no explanation. The party's gone so far off the right end, it's completely shocking to me. Even espousing ideologically the nearly horrific philosophy of that horrific woman, Ayn Rand, who one shouldn't take seriously as anything except a lesson in what happens when you lose all compassion, how you lose completely all balance. The Democrats, on the other hand, are offering no solution either. They're going after the same short term. Well, the Republicans are going for the long term destruction of the government. The Democrats are going for the short term. They want the gimmick. We're on our third stimulus right now, and the bill that is President Obama is campaigning for, his jobs program for next year, is the fourth. And I don't understand why. What is a one-year tax cut going to do to solve problems for America? Tax cut next year and then raising taxes afterwards? Nothing. He should tell us a decent way forward, not a one-year gimmick, which won't work. So the politics are broken. Finally, why are they broken? Because neither party wants to tax higher incomes. And without doing that, we can't pay for civilization in this country. The top has walked away with the prize, but they give back a little bit of it in campaign contributions. And this is how our politicians live. President Obama just about every week sits down to dinner with people who pay $35,800 a plate for dinner, and they're not generally begging him to raise their taxes. But he's not meeting the people who really need those tax revenues to be invested in education, in school loans, in rebuilding the infrastructure, and so on. And so even though he's campaigning for one slight adjustment, which I'm completely in favor of, raising the top rate from 35 to 39.6%, I can't believe that the full measure of recovery is 4.6 percentage points of the personal income tax. We need to tax our corporations again, which we're not doing. We've basically given them a green light to go to the Cayman Islands. We have the lowest corporate tax collections in modern history, about 1.4% of GNP this year in a year of high profits, because everybody understands transfer pricing, book your profits internationally, and park them at tax-free havens like the Caymans. That's how the system works. So we've gutted the corporate income tax. We have given tax cuts repeatedly at the top. And the result is that we can't pay for what we need to do. So let me close here with just a little bit of arithmetic. Our current tax system is taking in about 15% of GNP this year at the federal level. If the economy were fully recovered, that might be as much as 17% or 18% of GNP. But that amount can only cover Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, military, and interest payments. There's no money in the budget and a few other mandatory programs like veterans care. There's no money in the budget for a category that is called civilian discretionary spending. And what is that civilian discretionary spending? It is this. All of this, legislative branch, judicial branch, agriculture, commerce, education, energy, health and human services other than Medicare and Medicaid, housing and urban development, interior, environment, justice, labor, transport, all of that's paid for on borrowed money right now. Because we don't tax ourselves enough to fund the core of government. And if we don't have an infrastructure program, if we don't have an energy program, if we don't have a jobs training program, if we don't have an education program, we'll continue in this brutally tough global competition to decline. And that's the path. And those at the top will find their foothold. They'll create more and more employment abroad. They'll invest more and more of their money abroad. But we'll end up with a divided society, those at home who are struggling and those who have the means to escape this mess behind gated communities or into the international markets. In short, what I'm recommending in this book is a serious approach to investing in America's future again. No more gimmicks. And that means investing in higher education. It means investing in early childhood development. It means investing in what's called active labor market policies for retraining and for job skills. It means rebuilding our dilapidated infrastructure. It means addressing a serious energy system that makes a steady drive towards a low-carbon economy before we completely wreck the planet. And it does this in a way which would be inclusive for society, so that we're not catering to the top 20% or top 30% who are getting by quite well, but managing to keep America as a truly united and civilized country. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Sachs, for sharing your insights with us. My name is Michael Moritz. I'm a partner at Sequoia Capital, and I have the pleasure of moderating this evening's question and answer session. Let me begin by saying that I can see after that presentation why they call economics the dismal science. As you survey America, do you think there's any reason at all for hope?
When I wrote this book, I was really alarmed at what I thought the views of Americans were about these topics, and felt a sense of disconnection. But the more I looked into things, the more I realized that the problem wasn't the views of fellow Americans, but the views of the political machine. Because Americans, by quite large numbers, say we need to invest in the future, we need renewable energy, we need to end these absurdly costly, destructive dead-end wars, and we need to tax higher incomes. That's what the opinion surveys say. None of it happens politically, because our politics is dominated by powerful interests right now. These interests are first the financial markets, second to the health insurance industry, which made sure there was no real reform of the most overpriced, costly system in the world. Third, the military, which really is driving our foreign policy for those who look closely at how decision-making in Afghanistan and elsewhere was made. And then this general demonization of taxation at the top. And I find people, I'm sure there are a lot of people here who object to my calling for taxation, but let me explain one thing. I'm talking about taxation at the top of the income distribution. If you are a millionaire, a billionaire, you have a right to object to that on your grounds. But if you are a middle-class American, I feel you're doing the bidding of the super-rich by not focusing in on those issues, because it's the super-rich that are walking away with the unbelievable prize. And what I'm really saying quantitatively is raise one percentage point of GDP in the personal income tax, another one percentage point in higher corporate taxation, another 1% of GDP in net worth taxation, and another 1% of GDP between enforcement, carbon tax, and a few other odds and ends, and 4 percentage points of GDP would give us the means to start reinvesting in this country again. We'd actually have a shot at saving our government. Right now, without that, we're destroying all this civilian spending. So I'm talking about the top paying their due, paying their way. They are taking home so much. I know it in New York. Of course, you can't not see it in New York. We have the highest concentration of billionaires anywhere. Unfortunately, I have to say, a lot of them have a lot of disdain for the rest of society and just want to be left alone with their wealth. And that's why there are protests these days also on Wall Street, the Occupy Wall Street. It's no joke. Those are nice young kids who are trying to make a difference, and they deserve to be heard because what they're doing is right, and the point that they're making when they say we are the 99% is absolutely right. They are not, as Eric Cantor said, a mob. If you want to find a mob, it's Cantor and his cronies. That's a mob.
You are preaching to the choir here.
Yeah, so I'll keep preaching.
Now, I read your book with great interest. I spent much of yesterday reading it, and it did make me wonder, as you talked about the decline of America, whether in all your readings and journeying around the world, you've come up with an example of a country, a period of time, where there was an empire that had enjoyed a great moment in the sun that had been able to reverse its decline.
Well, I'm not a fatalist in any way. I have come up with a lot of countries that are able to do a good job of managing this complicated balance right now. Last week I was with a head of state of a northern European country. I don't want to name it because it was just a private conversation. But this head of state was really bemoaning America's lack of capacity to deal with its problems right now and expressing a lot of surprise and emphasizing that in that country, the finance ministry takes a seven-year perspective. It's looking seriously at numbers, at budgets, at options. There's a tremendous care taken in governance. This is all lacking in the United States now. Everything is improvisation. And when you go to the White House, as I do fairly regularly, although I think they're not thrilled when I get there, as you can see, I feel very much that it's what's the next 3 months agenda, that it's really David Plouffe, the political advisor that calls the shots probably more than anybody right now. Everything is focus grouped and everything is poorly managed. So I don't think it's the inevitability of imperial decline. I think it really is a political system that got overrun with money. It got overrun with corporate interests, and it got overrun with campaigning. So much we have all campaign and no governance anymore
in
this country.
Can I just ask you about that, Dr. Sachs?
Yeah.
Which is, what are your thoughts about the two-year congressional election
system? Absurd, isn't it? This was set in 1789. It's a tradition. We have the shortest election cycle of any major country in the world, of any high-income democracy by far. The average length of time between national elections and other places is 4 years. Most parliamentary governments have a five-year term, and maybe the election comes between the end of the fourth year and the end of the fifth year from an election. But we're in a two-year cycle, and these elections now cost around $4 billion each time. All these candidates are doing is dialing for dollars every day. That's what they do for a living, is that they look for money day in and day out. And they have to raise a lot, they think, because they think that the way to stay in power is to be able to run almost propagandistic imagery on our television sets, because we also do have this weird thing that you can seemingly sell almost anything in this country, or almost anybody. And so they do that through rather expensive imagery on commercial television, then they turn to the big bucks for money. And that's, I think, the core of our trap right now. And I'm waiting for somebody that's going to run for office, refusing all of these contributions and just using the free social media. This is going to be the way that the breakthrough is going to happen.
Wasn't his name Mike Bloomberg?
Well, not Mike Bloomberg. He spent a tremendous fortune of his own money. The person who was going to do that was Barack Obama. And in 2008, that was half his campaign, was a great grassroots movement. But then he bought a little insurance by bundlers on Wall Street. And that's the part we didn't know about. So what looked like a grassroots insurgent change-oriented movement, the day that he was elected, all of a sudden was Wall Street moving into the White House because they had paid for a lot of the campaign. And it turned out that it was very much a continuity government, not a change government afterwards. And I think money absolutely poisoned the relations. But then you saw it on the health care legislation also. I had a congresswoman who had her head in her hands in front of me saying, almost like Kurtz in The Heart of Darkness, instead of the horror, the horrors, she was saying, the lobbies, the lobbies, because this congresswoman was completely deluged by the lobbyists, and they felt that they couldn't take one step forward. That's where we're broken in this country, the money and the politics, not the values. Now, I do speculate, Michael, about one thing, which is, you know, have we become so immobilized in all of this that we can't get out of it? Because I worry in one of the chapters of the book that maybe television has completely deadened our capacity to actually respond. We're watching more TV than any other country in the whole world, average 5 hours per day per person, and it has really destroyed a lot of social capital. People don't show up. They don't get active, and I'm hoping that what we're observing of young people, that they're streaming the things they like, but they're not necessarily turning on the TV, that this may be part of the answer, and it may be part of the explanation why we are seeing young people all over the world saying enough is enough, and this spate of demonstrations that is now a worldwide phenomenon.
There are several questions, Dr. Sachs, here from the audience about a review of your book, that appeared recently in the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
That was written by Congressman Paul Ryan. And he wrote it with a very sharp pencil, I notice. And
it was in indelible ink.
the question from the audience is, did you expect such an attack from one of the top lawmakers on your book? And why do you think the review was so vicious?
There's not a lot of love lost between the two of us. And in fairness to Ryan, I've been calling him an irresponsible lout for a long time. And so this was his chance to get back to me. He is, in my view, an epitome of what's wrong with America. He is a right-wing he calls himself a libertarian, which to my mind is exactly the wrong philosophy of what we need. He professes to be an Ayn Rand disciple, which in my view is means a discipline of greed and absence of compassion. But more than that, he's a guy that's on the take because he's funded by David Koch. He's funded by the banking sector. He's funded by the real estate sector. He's a hack like the politicians are. He supports what his powerful constituencies want. All those libertarian ideas, let the market decide, let the market decide, let the market decide. When Wall Street was about to go belly up, there he was saying how important it was for the banks to be bailed out. So he was a leading spokesman for the TARP. Now, you know, you could defend TARP on certain principles that markets don't work, market failure and so on, but then you should have a little bit of consistency that maybe they don't work in other areas as well. But he just calls them as his campaign contributors see them. So I thought his review was what I would expect from the Wall Street Journal. They don't like me, and I like them even less. I think that Ryan, you know, he epitomizes our politics, but Rupert Murdoch, who owns the Journal and who owns Fox News, is a much greater danger. because he's got billions invested in this relentless corporate propaganda. He's one of the people most responsible in this country for confusing Americans about climate change, for basically telling them lie after lie, and helping to send this country and the world into an enormous danger. That's what billions from is unhinged from morality can do.
Dr. Sachs, speaking of people that you have a low opinion of.
Oh, we're just getting warmed up.
I noticed. I'll go straight to the G's in the alphabet. Greenspan.
Yeah.
He doesn't come in for kind treatment in your book. Why is that?
You know, it's interesting. He's another literal Ayn Rand disciple. He was in the inner core of Ayn Rand.
That's right.
By the way, I mention this. This may be esoterica for some people, but there's a whole political movement here which professes Ayn Rand as really their icon. And as part of writing this book, I went back to reread Atlas Shrugged. It's horrifying. I mean, it's really horrifying. There's the famous speech of John Galt about, and the speech, I remember being in a cold sweat by the end of reading this. In the middle of the night, because it really is, it says literally, if you give even pennies to the poor, you are leading the world to destruction, because you're feeding the worst of the moochers in society. If you give a smile to somebody that's undeserved, you're debasing yourself and contributing to the world's destruction. And normally, you know, some hack novel you wouldn't care about, except that this is actually propounded seriously by very powerful people in this country. And it is no joke when we've arrived at this degree of need and greed and these divisions. It's really a serious matter, ladies and gentlemen, and it deserves the attention. Now, Greenspan, I fault not for that, but I fault simply on his management at the Fed. But basically, I say that I think he had a wrong diagnosis. His model was, as long as there's low inflation, keep pumping up liquidity. And that model has a certain kind of logic in a closed economy. But in an open economy, what he was doing, in effect, was pumping up our consumer demand and the housing bubble, allowing us to borrow heavily from China and buy heavily from China. Inflation remained low, so he kept pumping, and he kept denying in one open market committee after another that there was any danger of a real estate bubble or these other things, and the staff kept coming to him and saying, but Mr. Chairman, we see real problems here, and he missed the whole thing. And then after the biggest collapse in financial history, in congressional testimony, he said he detected a flaw in his philosophy. Well, how much sympathy can you have in that case?
There's one question here from the audience, this person would like your thoughts on a topic that they say, Dr. Sachs, that you haven't said anything about, which is the increase in government spending in the last 40 years in Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid, where it went from, I think it says here, 19% of government spending in 1970 to 43% of all government spending in 2010. What are your thoughts on those three ornery topics?
Medicare, Social Security, and
Medicaid.
And Medicaid, yeah. Basically, I think that these are successful programs and very important programs. Medicare was crucial in ending poverty of the elderly in this country, and so was Social Security. The elderly used to have very chronic high poverty rates, And these two programs decisively change that. And these are contributory programs, people pay into them. The Social Security gap is modest because we have a payroll tax, and it can be adjusted without a terrible problem. Medicaid covers about two percentage points of GDP right now, and it's vital for poor people in this country to have health care. No other high-income country even debates this proposition, only the United States. And Mr. Ryan proposed in his budget earlier this year to slash Medicaid spending. The problem with our health system is not the government provision of health care for the rich, I'm sorry, for the elderly or for the poor. The problem is we have the most overpriced health care system in the world. And that's not because of those two programs. Those two programs are 5 percentage points of GDP, but our health spending is 17% of GDP. The 12% is the private health insurance industry. That's the main driver of our excessive costs. And the way we've organized our healthcare system to give these profit-making health insurers the lead, to give the AMA the key decision of who comes into different parts of the health field and what the reimbursement rates are for different procedures, and because we have encouraged doctors to own the equipment like MRIs and so forth, the very unusual in the world, leading to massive incentives for massive overprescription of use, we end up with a system which is 50 to 100% more expensive than any other system in the world. We're paying 17% of our gross national product to get 9 or 10% of GNP in services. Other countries are spending 10% and with better health outcomes than we're getting. And so this isn't because of Medicare and Medicaid. This is because we need fundamental health care reform. We're the only country that let the private sector run away with it. And that's, again, the lobbies. And President Obama decided from the first moment he wasn't going to fight any of the lobbies. So he wanted to tie up support of the health insurers, the pharmaceutical industry. And he said, don't oppose this. We just want to bring in more people into the private health insurance sector. We won't go for a public option. We won't go for any deep reform. And so we got a little bit more coverage, but at the expense of locking in this incredibly overpriced system. That's what we have to take care of. That requires not just slashing health for the elderly or for the poor. It requires reform of the health system itself.
You grew up in Detroit. What's your opinion about the government bailout of the automobile industry, and in particular the fact that the starting wage for a worker in the automobile industry these days is $14 an hour, which equates roughly to the poverty line for a family of four?
Well, I supported the bailout because I said that if we don't have that, we're going to destroy the Midwest. We have a tremendous engineering capacity, and it was about to be decimated. What I said was at the time, and I recommended this policy, was that we ought to have a coherent and consistent national energy and transport policy, and the Midwest should be once again a center of engineering excellence to bring that about. I thought the Chevy Volt of GM was, for example, a pioneer, and I believe it to be a pioneering car in electric vehicles and a demonstration of what our engineering can do. So I think that part was needed. What's missing, though, really sadly missing, is we don't have an overarching strategy for anything. This bailout isn't part of a larger strategy. There is no climate change strategy. There is no energy policy strategy. There is no renewable energy grid strategy. We don't have any strategy in the energy sector. And we need that if we're going to make the electric vehicle industry what it should be as a leading edge for not only our own industrial capacity, but for a safe, secure, and environmentally sustainable transport and energy system in this country. That's what I thought the bailout would be the first step to do, but the next steps have not yet come.
Unfortunately, we've reached that point in our program where we have time for just one last question, and that question is this. In 2020, is America going to be better or worse off than we are today?
Well, my book offers a way for it to be better off, so I hope people have a look at it, and I hope that they will debate it. And I hope that it will help to contribute to a renewal of a serious and longer-term discussion. That's the right time horizon for us to be thinking about. Where are we going to be in a decade from now, and how are we going to get there? We can find a way out of this. America has done much tougher things in the past, but in order to do it, we're going to have to find a new direction from the one that's on offer by either party in Washington.
Thank you, Dr. Sachs. Author of The Price of Civilization.
On behalf of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, I hope you enjoyed this evening's program. We'd like to thank Professor Jeffrey Sachs, Director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, and author of The Price of Civilization, Reawakening American Virtue and Prosperity, Michael Moritz, managing partner at Sequoia Capital, our audience here in Palo Alto, and those of you joining us on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.